This meeting is now being recorded.
So Carlton, I'm going to let you take it away with presenting your reading list items.
Sorry. Carlton, for the record. My first one was that I can register agreements. Notice that they said register agreements. And this one speaks directly to topic four, the procedural issues. You'll recognize that it says register agreements because there is a base agreement, but then depending on the registry, you could have changes, substantive changes sometimes, to the base registry because of the bilateral negotiations. The base agreement formally covers in about seven articles there. The intention, the expectations for the delegation operation of the GTLD. And it also frames the process by which they can be amended and so on. As it relates to our procedures for safeguards, trust, and consumer protections, I was really looking at it to see where the responsibilities, if it actually says anything about the responsibilities for this. And there are a couple of things that jump out at you. The first thing is that the base agreement is considered a community developed agreement. A lot of people will have a big issue with that, and they think it is because it was put to public comment. That's the rationale for it. The amendments is bilateral between ICANN and a group representing the registry stakeholders. The community may comment on them, but there's really no standing otherwise to negotiate the agreement. I can tell you that when we were in the ALAC, we tried to get in on the negotiations, that we were rebuffed. The base contract is 10 years, renewable. Here's something that is interesting, the technical acceptance, that is to say the user technical acceptance of it. The agreement says clearly that it is the registry operator that has that burden, not ICANN. So if users have a problem using the domain, it is the operator that is at fault, and they're the ones who have the total burden of ensuring that that is operating. The services that the registry offer must be approved by ICANN, and they must also be in line with the consensus policies. Any variation that you have to that service agreement is the very first article there that says what the services the registry will provide. Those have to be approved as well. Price changes must be notified to ICANN and registrar. There's a new policy now. They're just out for public comment. That ICANN now says that you don't have to notify them of the price changes. And that is a new update to this policy. That's out for comment. I think I don't think that is unreasonable. After all, the registry is still required to notify the registrars are the ones that have more skin in this game than anybody else. Registry fee consists of two parts. There's a fixed fee, and then there's a transactional fee. It compels the registry operator to escrow registration data, and the escrow agent must be approved by ICANN. Of course, there's the WHOIS publication, the registry WHOIS. There's a publication requirement for that. Here's something that you see. It's in terms of dispute resolution, the preference is for mediation and arbitration. If you can't meet the first one, mediation, then you go to arbitration. And then presumably, if there's a stalemate at arbitration, then something else might follow. But what is important here is, even with respect to their dispute resolution, there are some articles in the registry agreement that are ring-fenced. They cannot be part of the resolution framework. And interestingly, Spec 11, which covers the PICs, is one of those. SLAs are also excluded, and the consensus policies, those pertaining consensus policies, are also excluded. And if you look through the base contract, you will notice that clauses 6 and 7 are the pertinent ones there in respect of those exclusions. The registry operator is compelled by contract to indemnify and defend ICANN. Indemnify and defend. And it's directors, officers, employees, and agents. It was very specific what it says. From all third-party suits, liabilities, costs, and damages. And some people believe, at least in the community that I caucus with, there's always been a talk that maybe if we had third-party liability, enforcement would be a lot stricter. Just throwing it out. Compliance, because there's always going to court. So compliance would be stricter because I cannot have third-party liability risks. And therefore, it would be much more quick to enforce the rules. The registry is obliged to report specific data every month in a specified format, and that is just the compliance reports. You see, we have I believe the list also contains some examples of the compliance reports. We say all that, though, to say that the amendment process, and remember, this is a base agreement, and so when you have the bilateral negotiations, that is considered an amendment process. And it can only be initiated by ICANN or the RST, the Registry Stakeholder Group, once a year. And then if you're deadlocked, you have to go into mediation, and then if that fails, then you go to arbitration. The amendments are also subject to public comments period, and all the registries are notified. So even if I am having an amendment with one registry, as long as there's agreement, you have to publish that for comment. And everybody in the stakeholder group must be notified one-to-one. It's very interesting. Public comment period must last a minimum of 30 days, and that can be extended by ICANN. And you do have a model that says that we take into account public comments after them, and then they may incorporate public comments into the final agreement. Most people are not so willing to say that is a process that works very well. So far, we haven't seen any real examples of any significant change in that context. The final agreement becomes effective 60 days after the legal notice is served on all of the registry stakeholder group. And I just made a note there that says the specifications 6, 7, 10, and 11 are the ones that we are most interested in this group because they relate to safeguards and trusts. So, in my view, I'm looking at it, the third party liability is probably the only issue here that I think is of any great substantive change to that. You have a process for amending the base agreement. You have a process for public comment. And the only major change that I would see in terms of this agreement is if they were to adopt third-party liability, in my view. That's the only substantive thing I think they could do.
So let me just ask you also to comment on, I understand that you are looking at the agreement and thinking about how things can be improved, but let me also ask you to be a little more explicit about how you think that relates to the new GTLD program and consumer trust, if you can draw that connection more explicitly.
Right. The safeguards and trusts are contained in clauses 6, 7, 10, and 11. And they actually have rights protection mechanisms, availability of the domain. They talk about abuse mitigation, name collisions, and so on. All of these elements are there. Those elements are actually not subject to mediation or arbitration. They're not. They're outside of it. So if there's a dispute, if I am a user and have a dispute in regard to any of those safeguards, I don't have standing in the dispute. I do not. It's very clear. It says those are outside of the dispute resolution process. So I don't see any substantive change that you could bring to this agreement through that process. I really don't see anything that you could do, because the ones that we're concerned with are ring-fenced from arbitration and mediation. So if the only major difference that you could have invoked in this instance is if you had third-party liability capabilities assigned in the contract.
Okay, so you raised two different issues. One is of standing and one is of third-party liability.
Right.
So, and also you talked about the fact that the safeguards are carved out,
yes,
of the mediation and dispute resolution. But what about the dispute resolution process that is put in place for the public interest commitments, which is where some of the safeguards are? I mean, what your statement doesn't talk about that.
No, it doesn't, because we go back to the next one now. If you look at the registrar agreement, there is a very interesting, the policies, the abuse policies between the registry and the registrar actually embraces a lot of those that are carved outside of the registry agreement, which is the one I'm going to go. So, for example, if you look at the affiliates abuse policy, if you look at the Dot Rich policy, and just to contrast the affiliates, you know, the ones that affiliates cover, and you look at the Dot Rich policies, which is new, GTLD, the domain abuse policies between the registry and the registrar actually gives users some opportunity to become involved in the dispute resolution because they can make complaints there. But specific to the registry agreement between ICANN and the registrar, the end user don't have standing in the dispute there. It is a bilateral process between the registry operator and ICANN. But the registry has in their domain abuse policy an opening for end users to raise abuse issues with the registry and the registrar. I think that's where you can attack it, in the domain, the abuse policies of registries. Registry and registrars. The RRA is the registry-registrar agreement. All the registries have agreements with their registrars, and they have appended to that the domain abuse policy, and they enforce those. Some don't enforce them as rigorously as others, but they do have these policies. And I looked at a couple more of them. It's not just Affilias and Dot Rich. I looked about 10. It's not exhaustive, this, given the numbers, but I look at about 10, and they tend to have the same kind. Let me, for example, tell you what they say. Just to jump to that. They cover the same things, acceptable use, and then they talk about what are the unacceptable use, or some just say wrong or bad use or of the domain, excessive use of power, position or ability, illegal or fraudulent actions, spam, phishing, farming, willful distribution of malware, faxless, hosting, botnet command control, distribution of child pornography, illegal access to other computers or networks. So the abuse policies have a very wide net to capture abuse complaints from users. And that's how I think they actually go about responding to abuse from end users. And we are specifically looking now at safeguards to end users. I'm saying at the ICANN registry level, there's not much. But at the registrar level, there is a wide net to capture all of that.
Just to make sure I understand, what you're suggesting as a recommendation is to give end users more standing to address safeguards issues with registries. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. I think it would be useful to have users at the ICANN registrar level in a more direct way, I think. Right now, they have no role. None at all.
Yes, Abra, for the record, I will go the same way as Carlton is arguing, because if you use them as a second level of for end users to complain and so on, and if you give visibility for what they do,
yes.
So then we have the issue of reputation.
Yes.
So then we have the public reputation, and this is a driving motor for them to allocate costs, because we know that increases costs,
right,
in exchange of differentiation in the ranking of reputation.
I that's my feeling too. It's Calvin.
Okay, Calvin Brown for the record. So we've got three relationships. We've got the registrant, mm-hmm, and the registrar relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the registrar and the registry relationship, and then,
yep,
we've got the registry and the ICANN relationship. I guess there's a fourth one, which is the registrar or ICANN relationship as
right,
well.
Right.
So you saying, okay, well, that registrant relationship, now you're going to create a new relationship between the registrant and the registry, or a potential for the registrant or registry to come into play somehow. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
Because I think registrars might not like that when you're giving their clients... I'm just trying to figure out how that works, because it's the registrar's client. Now you're creating another relationship.
Bring it up the chain.
Yeah, traditionally...
Because there's a reputational risk associated with the registrar. They do have a reputational risk.
I'm just seeing red flags here, and I'm not sure why. I maybe need to sleep on them and figure out why.
This is Carolyn. So I'm wondering if you can, I'm trying to think of an example of a case where an end user is wanting to complain about a safeguard and having some recourse at the registrar level will be assistance. So Barbara or Carlton, you're both seem to be in agreement. So just trying to think of a case where that would maybe illustrate this.
Well, what I'm saying actually in one line is that the PICS safeguards, as they are now, they don't embrace registrants. They do not, as they are right now. Because with the carve out, they are not recognized as having an interest in that. That's the first thing. And secondly, I'm also saying, based on my reading of the document, the first place you see the registrants and users actually coming into play in terms of safeguards is in the domain abuse policy that most registries have in the registry registrar agreement. So that's where it stops. So the PICS that we're talking about, Spec 11, the Spec 11 is a bilateral agreement between ICANN and the registry. That's it. That's where it stops.
This is Karen. So correct me if I'm wrong. Can anyone file a PICS DRP complaint?
No, not in this case.
Which case?
Not from the registry agreement, no. If you have a dispute, first of all, it doesn't recognize that you can have a dispute in the PICS outside of the mediation arbitration process. You can't. And it's a bilateral. The mediation arbitration process is a bilateral movement between ICANN and the registry operator. That's it. So you don't have any standing to go in front of ICANN where that is concerned as an end user, because it's clear from the dispute resolution that it is mediation, arbitration, and you cannot just walk up and invoke those. That's how I read it. Maybe it's it.
Well, I'm trying to clarify the case that you're talking about, so I make sure we're talking about the same thing. But you know, according to there's a form, on the ICANN side where anyone submits a complaint regarding a PIC, and then I think like that's kind of a precursor to filing an actual. Proceeding is that, you make the registry aware of the complaint and they have some opportunity to resolve it. And then I'm looking for the actual, you know, PIC dispute resolution procedure in terms of who has the, you know, the ability to actually bring a case. But I'm not sure if that's the type of complaint about a safeguard that you're trying to address here.
As far as we read it, yes, the PIC DRP only responds to ICANN and the registry operator. That has been always one of the things that the at large has been concerned about. And if you read it, it's very clear what the process is. It's dispute resolution is if there's something wrong, PICs and the safeguards are carved out. And PICs and safeguards is Spec 11. Spec 11 of the contract. Spec 6, 7, and 10 have other safeguards that we are interested in. And it is very clear that those are ring fence from the dispute resolution. And they are bilateral.
Okay, so this is Karen. I'm just taking a look at the PIC DRP here, but maybe don't hold up the discussion, just if others have comments. Thanks.
Okay. Yes, Fabro.
Yeah, Fabro, for the record, I just ask you to upload here the four things that we are discussing in words. So basically, nowadays, there's no link between registrants and registry. Then the idea would be to create a link between them. Okay.
Okay. Well, I think no. I think what people are struggling with is that this is a complicated topic and really revolves around the specific language in these agreements and the legal interpretation of it. And I think it's hard actually to have that conversation in the abstract. So maybe what I'll ask you to do, Carlton, is maybe come back to us where you can walk us through the language so that we have a shared understanding of what you're talking about in terms of who has standing to bring a complaint when there's a public interest commitment that an end user believes has been violated, which is what I think you're getting at. I think we would all be helped by you walking us through your understanding of these contract provisions, because this really does depend on the specific language. And when you're talking about carve-outs and who has standing, that gets to be really dependent upon the precise language there, and I think we would just benefit from that. But as a high level, what I hear you saying is that in terms of who's accountable, who has to deal with complaints, you're concerned that the registries don't have to deal with complaints, and you're raising the question of, well, should they have to deal with complaints from the end users? Am I understanding it right?
Because I'm assuming that they have registries involved there, and maybe it would be a good thing. But you can see from that that there's no connection between the end user
right.
and the registry. Not in this new resolution at all. You can complain that I can, but that's as far as it goes.
Mm-hmm. Liability, then maybe that would be a
But I'll come back to you in the specific language.
Yeah, I just think people would benefit from a more detailed explanation with the language and maybe even a visual. Yeah. Yeah, a visual base. Yeah, I mean that explains the relationships, but it doesn't explain the contract provisions and the carve-outs, which I also think people might benefit from having not only a text explanation, but also maybe a visual one.
Sorry. Every registry has an agreement with the registrars. On top of that, required on the RRA 2013 to only deal with accredited registrars, they also have their own instrument that attaches the registrar to them. And in that instrument, the RRA, they have an anti-abuse policy defined in there. And the anti-abuse policy actually refers to some of the safeguard and trust issues that are in the base registry agreement in clauses 6, 7, 10, and 11. And some of them go and they actually enumerate the types of abuse that they're concerned about. For example, affiliates, it goes through and it actually lists them, the type of abuses that they're concerned about. If you look at the .rich one, which I'll just do here too, it's the language is a little bit more abstract, but that's all it is. It doesn't quite go through and list all the ones that affiliates does. But if you look at the language that it uses, it tends to be more expansive. It covers a whole lot of things. You could push a whole lot through it without it being definitive about what the actual abuse is that they would be interested in. What I think it does, though, is that in the context that we are looking at, this is a vehicle that the end user can actually use to bring attention to abuses for safeguards, and trust with the registry directly. Because this allows the end user to actually interact with the registry operator with respect to those abuses. So I think at this level, there is a way, there's a vehicle. Some of them actually outline very clearly what the steps are for you. There's an anti-abuse contact. There's a form that you're allowed to fill in and so on and so on. There's a commitment to respond to it within a certain time period and so on. So they're very specific as to who you contact, how you lay out the charges, and they kind of frame it in forms that they provide online for users to put in. There's very little difference between them. I think it's most important to notice that this is a robust and well configured way for end user to get involved with the registry operator in respect of safeguards and trust issues. So that's there. And it seems to work. If you look at the they are no required to report abuses and their response to abuses. And if you look at some of the compliance reports, you will see actual records of the registry operator reporting those abuses. I can tell you from our perspective, the issue has always been whether or not they are as diligent as they should. Let me give you an example. The big one is the farmer. As you know, there's this legal farmer thing. And Nugent, for example, has always maintained that the reports themselves do not do justice to the harm that is done to the end user, because by the time the registry actually investigates, then the harm is running into millions. I'm not so sure you could get it better, because I still believe that you have to have due process. And that's part of the problem. The registry is not, most of the registries are not willing to do automatic takedowns of the kind that would probably satisfy a consumer protection advocate, because they have to investigate and so on and so on. I think that's where the disconnect actually comes into play. The registries, they have these processes, they have these policies, but there are well-defined due process steps. And sometimes by the time they go through that, then the harm escalates, the harm is done. That's where that that is. I think it's important for us to look at those, because if for nothing else, they would allow us to start gathering more data about the types of abuses and maybe identify the registries that are prone to being abused. Maybe that will tell us something. And with respect to the new GTLDs, if I believe that you have to make a comparison between them and the legacy GTLDs to see if the uptick, if there's an uptick, and maybe from the data you kind of extrapolate what might have caused the uptick. Is it because they are more lax in enforcement? Is it because they are responding to competitive pressure and be a little bit less, you know, diligent about going after people? If you have a guy who was 100,000, who registers 100,000 domains, for example, what would it be your response to them as opposed to a guy who registers 3 domains? That kind of thing. It's one of the things that have been coming up time to time in our conversation. So then the next one that I looked at was the Global Consumer Research Report. This does not reflect the data that was presented this morning, because I just didn't have access to it. What you see here is the 2015 report. We know a couple of things. The service commissioned by ICANN to measure consumer awareness, choice, and trust, the GTLDs in general, new GTLDs in particular. The methodology, as was stated earlier this morning, make a distinction between end users and registrants. And you notice that the registrant part of this has not started yet. And what we got this morning is a draft update, which is the second part to this that was expected. From the old part, we wanted to see if trust and confidence in the DNS is impacting the new GTLDs differently from the legacy GTLDs, and whether or not we could trace it to any specific GTLDs. They went out on the field with a sample size of over 6,000. It was an online survey. They had 18-plus-year-old as responders to the survey. It was done in 24 countries and across the continent, all the continents.
So, Carlton, since we've had presentations by Nielsen on this, what I would say is assume we're familiar with what has happened,
right,
and cut straight to how you think this is useful for
okay.
us.
It's useful to the extent that it's baseline data about awareness. They looked at they used visitation as the ground floor for awareness. And they found that almost half of the people that they surveyed were familiar with at least one new GTLD. That's a good thing. We would want to look and see how much of that is improved. And if you notice, there's some slight uptick on that in today's presentation. So we have a baseline in 2015. And what we could do now is look at the new figures for 2016 to see how that has shifted. And that would provide us with a good baseline for determining whether or not the awareness has risen in all of the areas and where we might improve the awareness quotient by doing some things like we are advocating using different channels to talk about it. So that's all I'll say on that. And this one only has to do with topics 2 and 3, which is consumer behavior and user behavior and the developing economies issue. If you notice in the Nielsen that was presented today, I didn't sense that there was a clear enough distinction between what was happening in developing economies and in any of the end user behavior measurements. I certainly did not get that we had a clear distinction between that. You could say some things about Latin America and the Caribbean and so on, and Africa and so on. But I didn't think, for example, the one that Wada was talking about, that 36% of Africans were aware of that email. it's kind of a, I would drill down a little bit more to find out why dot email has such a high awareness in Africa. I would want to know a little bit more about that. But that's what the numbers suggest here. So I think it's a good thing because we have the 2015 results and we now have the 2016 results. We can see what has changed and maybe we could drill down a little bit to see where the trust elements and maybe even with when we look at it in detail again, because today was a draft report we look at, we might see some other things that will help us to pull out issues in the developing economies, which is why we're interested in the global research anyways. And then finally I did the last two, and I put them together, the ESAC advisories. SAC 41 had a recommendation to prohibit the use of redirection and synthesized responses by new TLDs, and they had an advisory on best practices of how to reduce the cybersecurity risks associated with new GTLDs as well as with the operating support systems that support new GTLDs. So if you have a registry, the registry operates as a platform for the wholesale. The registrar have a platform that sells names and so on. So they were not just concerned about the domain name phishing and so on. They were concerned about the systems that people in the chain use to provision domain names. Why are we interested in it? It's because that they feel it would be harmful to the stability and security of the system if you can poison the message chain. That is the first one, SAC-41. Essentially, SAC-41 says that if you have a request and it's a series of questions, the conversation, if you are in the middle somewhere and you can capture the request, you could actually substitute a response to the name server, and in so doing, you could do malodorous things. That's what SAC-41 essentially says. And they are suggesting that you prohibit the behavior that will allow that to happen. And then in the final one, they actually gave a list of best practices that would improve the overall cybersecurity framework online. So I think those two together essentially speak about the impact or the threat to stability and security if you encourage practices that allow an attack to poison the conversation in the DNS. And the way you institutionalize the security frames and the security behavior is that you follow some best practice, and they gave them simple best practice guidelines. That's all I would want to say about that.
Any questions for Carlton about that?
So maybe that's what we do. Carlos is referring is that the PDP, subsequent procedures PDP, had sent out a request to the ACs to give them some feedback on some issues that are of concern to them. And they sent it to SAC. And SAC spoke about this one, but then they also mentioned three others that they think would be germane to the issue of security. So Carlos is suggesting, and I'm agreeing with Carlos, that we add those to the numbers in our reading list.
So, Alice, can we add those to the reading list?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so Fabro, I know we're not going to get through all of yours in the 10 minutes we have, but I thought we could at least get started. Thank you, Carlton, for your very good discussion of those somewhat complicated topics.
Okay, shall I go?
Yes.
So Fabro, for the record, I think the first one, I will select them. I think the curse of the URL shorteners, I think, is a key one to discuss. So It's a sulfur curse. Yeah? It should be at the bottom. Yeah. So, this one I think is important because we measured for URL shorteners in the Nielsen. There's increasing use of this tool, and there's a huge challenge for TLDs based on that. So what they're doing, it's a simple research. They're looking for abuse of services that provide URL shorteners, and the results are quite interesting. They show that, let's see if they have included, this limited experiment shows that URL shortening services have a long way to go before internet users can trust them to deliver safe links. About half of the most popular services seems to be somehow effective at blocking access to well-known malicious URLs. So basically they got all the services, they got a list of websites that they knew should be blocked, made the test, and half of the services failed. This means that this is a bypass to everything else that we're doing and might be an area where we can address things here. Would you like me to explain more or spend more time here?
So tell us, sorry, this is Laureen. Yep. So tell us, Fabro, how sync that up to our focus on new GTLDs and consumer trust.
Yeah.
Let's be a little more explicit about that.
That's the shortcoming of the research because it makes no differentiations between legacy and generic. So this is an issue, which we might like to add eventually. It's a very simple methodology they use. So it's not something you can frequently monitor, but it's something that we can run once or twice, and then we can check for that. It'll actually be interesting to see.
Can I say? Maybe, Fabro, if you tell a little bit about how the shorteners actually work, it'll show
yeah.
you why.
Yeah.
It is important to us. That's what it was.
Yeah. So the shorteners work as a mask. So when you have a long URL, you just include it and make it short. Twitter is famous for using it because you have a limited number of characters. So instead of putting the whole thing, you just include 10, 11 characters and make the job. It becomes popular now with Google, with Facebook, with Bitly, with lots of services providing this. Because it works as a mask, basically you click and you have no way to read what kind of TLD is involved in that whatsoever.
So that's very helpful. And what I hear you explicitly saying is that this is really a data request for us. Is there a way to gather information that compares legacy GTLDs and their use of URL shortening services and abuse related to URL shortening services with new GTLDs
yes,
and the same.
Exactly.
So I just wanted to make that as
clear.
Explicit.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. We have, for example, QR codes that are being more used, but we don't have the market concentration that we have for shorteners. So we could not regulate that market somehow because everyone is creating QR codes. But for the shorteners, there's a huge concentration. And eventually, there's a trust issue. If I see a shortener with Bitly, which is a major one, I tend to click and trust. If I say it's Fabrily, I don't know the shortener, so I don't click. So it might be a good test to run.
Maybe one more?
Yeah. So the last one is the Symantec Intelligence Report. So it's a private sector company, a major antivirus and similar tools supplier, and they're just looking at what are the major threats were detected. It doesn't mean they go through, but they were detected. And this is the source that I said is related to banks and financial services. So just a little bit, can you just put a little bit down? Is the second, yes. So it's a descriptive analysis of evolution of internet threats. Just a little bit up. Yep. But they're looking at targeted attacks, phishing, vulnerabilities, malware, mobile social media, and spam. So key findings are public administration was the most targeted sector. Organizations with between 250 and 500 employees were most likely to be targeted. In terms of target attacks, in general, the finance, insurance, and real estate sector was the most targeted. And then when you look at the data, it becomes quite clear that these are the low-hanging fruits for attacks from that point of view. So this might be an argument for us to suggest that some DTLDs might be more reliable, more related to scrutiny than others. What I'm saying is that it's not based on the use, but based on the use for threats. Then we might make a segregation here, a second records.
So what I hear you saying is that the Symantec study identifies what types of GTLDs are more likely to be the object of threats or attacks, and that might inform our inquiries into the issue of restricted registration policies, for example.
Exactly. If we have to draw a line, that would be a criteria to select where to draw it.
Okay. Questions for Fabro as we approach our 5 o'clock hour.
I don't have a question.
But you have a comment, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Fabro. This is Carlos. There is another Symantec report which has a slightly different structure from 6 months earlier. So we might just put them together. This is called, the title is Internet Security Threats. So it organizes the threats in different chapters. And there is one section about only 10 pages long because the report is 120 plus pages. There is one section of 10 pages on web threats, which I think is out of this report, the only relevant part there. So it would be useful if we put the two Symantec reports together. Thank you.
So, Alice, maybe on the chart you could put those, lump those together so that since they're related, even though we have two different people looking at it, they're linked.
It's called ISTR20.
I'm on it.
Yeah, just for the record, the SAC reports, SSAC reports that I looked at was 41 and 74. And they the SAC chair added 45, 62, and 66. To the list. So we're adding 45, 62, and 66 because they've recommended that those are germane to the security issue. And by the way, now that Steve is here, he has a hand in quite a few of those. So he could respect it. He could probably tell you something straight away about them.
So this relates back to our earlier discussion of adding those papers to our list for reading to see what the recommendations are. Yeah? Okay. And David, who has so compliantly put his placard up to make a comment, you are next.
It's a comment, so a question. When we're talking about the most targeted GTLDs, et cetera, I think it's to me, there's the two points which you might have mentioned. Whether a TLD is targeted like a dot bank, because we're going to go for Barclays.bank as an example, so it's targeted because they think it's a clearly a domain name, second and top level, that's worth targeting. So that's one element. But the other element is where we've got abuse coming from the TLD. So that can be targeted by people to send out from. So it's kind of a two-way process. And I'm wondering whether we can capture that and whether any of the other combined stuff we're looking at does touch on either of those or those together.
Yeah, in the Symantec report, it's them. The bank, not the second level. All the readings I had, they don't mention that. So I will rephrase my argument, saying that when I say that dot bank or dot finance or dot something, is more likely the threat, I refer to the topic, to the theme, to the industry, not necessarily to the generic. My research that I read doesn't allow us to make the connection.
Because I think that's obviously for us on the trust and safeguards, that's an issue. We've got a TLD that's being abused, or the registry is allowing it to be abused to do something. So that really is an issue which goes to the trust and everything. So I'm not sure how we can look at that, but we need to try.
So the distinction I hear you making, I just want to make sure I understand it for myself. You're distinguishing between the issue of what types of domains are more susceptible to threats and the separate issue of how registries can enact policies that either decrease risks or increase risks. Am I getting it?
No.
Please retool.
Not sure. I think so. But it's looking at it from the point of view of somebody of going both ways. You've got the bad guy who's targeting a TLD because it thinks that it's going to get some good stuff from that TLD, from the second level registrations under it. So your bad guy who's anywhere in the world is targeting. But whether a TLD is a home for bad guys is a second point where they can, they're allowed to, so then you're seeing a lot of stuff coming from that TLD. And if the registry sees that but does nothing, that's an issue. And whether there's any Symantec or anybody else who's looking at that and saying, ah, yes, there's much more abuse coming out of this TLD than that TLD, and then what do we do? Because that, to me, is something to certainly be looking at. And touches right, you know, it's right on our area.
Just a review. I remember the previous review I did with Knuj on, not sure how to say it, but the previous literature review I did. And they have for every generic TLDs, I tried to look here if they have .bank. They don't. But as far as I remember, based on their expertise, and the data is based on spam, spam, yeah, that they receive, except for two or three major generic, all the uses of dot something for malware is, and vulnerabilities is minor. So maybe we don't even have lots of dot banks being used for that.
I don't think it would ever be a dot bank. It would be a dot something generic. I mean, we've got anecdotal evidence because we've gone after some of these registrations under that, but it's not necessarily the TLD. But then you look at the TLD concerned and you think, ah, what are they doing? And then that goes a little bit outside our remit of shutting one down or shutting two down, but we've only gone after half a dozen. But I'm imagining if we've gone after half a dozen, then we're not the only ones going after them, so there's got to be quite a bit out there.
So now I want to make sure I understand the schedule, and I'll ask our ICANN staff. Am I correct that the other review team is supposed to be joining us in here? Mm-hmm. And they're not here yet, yes? Okay. So we have a choice. We can. I'm loath to let you escape the room, but we can either continue. Fabra, you can either continue with your presentations, or we can take a break primarily inside the room. I'm not going to bar the doors, but I'm just mindful that when the other group joins, it would be most efficient if we're still already in the room as opposed to scattered. So what would folks like to do? Say it? Yeah, so I'm seeing heads nodding. So, Fevra, why don't you just continue with your presentations, and we'll just stop when the other groups join us.
Okay, so you're stuck with me.
No.
So redirecting DNS for ads and profit volunteer. Basically, what they do in this report, they know it's a proxy where when you look for something and you don't find, someone redirects you to another website that can have a profit based on that. So they call error traffic monetization solutions, leverage the context provided by ISPs, customer traffic, in order to rewrite protocol error message to valid responses. They see this as a proxy, and for example, the interesting fact is that most monetization occurs in Italy, 40%, US, Brazil, yes, Argentina, yeah, Germany, Austria, and other countries is just minor. So some countries are exploiting these more than others. Is it related to registries, registrants, or who is to be blamed for that? It's not clear because they couldn't track exactly who is responsible for that. But it suggests that ICANN wants to fight redirecting DNS, so they quote a report where ICANN wants to do it. There is a possibility of end user threats in redirection DNS. If I can redirect you, maybe eventually can redirect you for some purpose, but because it's in the hub of redirecting, because it requires a big player to do it, it won't be the common threat. It needs to be a very sophisticated threat and someone being responsible for that. However, considering that up to one-third of traffic is redirecting some major countries, there is a possible urge to tackle the issue. Now, this is not a generic TLD's particular issue, so I don't think it's something we should take in under consideration.
Okay. So it's interesting, but it's not really something we're going to pursue. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you, Fabro, for getting through what you did. Now we're going to go back to our plenary group, and I'll let someone else take the helm here. Thanks everyone who made their presentations and everyone staying so engaged. And a special thanks to Fabro, who actually volunteered for his articles, and those of you who also volunteered for your articles, because I really appreciate that.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. This is a somewhat unstructured part of our program. What might be worth doing is literally taking 3 minutes apiece between Jordan and Laureen to just talk a little bit about what you did in your SUM team and what you're likely to talk about with the rest of the group tomorrow, like what kinds of questions we were trying to ask, that sort of thing, and then how the use of the template's coming or whatever. And then I know that we've got another celebrity guest here in the form of Steve Crocker. So we might want to give him a few minutes to share some thoughts about the review as well. So why don't we start with Laureen, a little bit of a report back, and then I'll go to you, Jordan. And
so we spent the afternoon primarily engaged in two tasks. First of all, Brian led us on a very helpful discussion of the safeguards and how we might measure the effectiveness or impact of the safeguards. And these ran the gamut from the public interest commitments, rights protection mechanisms, and other required safeguards. I think it's led us to an interesting analysis of what we can measure, how deep we want to go in different topics, and also a realization that we're not going to be able to do everything. We're not going to be able to gather data on every single safeguard. There's not going to be data on every single safeguard, and it really is going to be an important and, I'll say, crucial part of our task to prioritize which safeguards we want to focus on. That prioritization is going to be key. So that was the first part of our discussion. The second part of our discussion focused on our still expanding reading list of articles, data sources, reports that we have divided up, and every team member has responsibility for certain sources. Every team member is now giving reports back on these sources through, and I'll borrow Jonathan's good phrase, the prism of our task to consider whether the new GTLD program has had an impact on consumer trust. And this exercise has been both informational, i.e. share with the group about what you've read, and then two, a sort of green light or red light about whether this particular source is useful for our effort or not, and if it is useful, how. So that's what we've been getting summaries about. We've heard from Drew, from Carlton, and from Fabro about a variety of different sources and how they may be useful to our effort. So that's my short summary.
And do you feel, is the sense of your group that they are easily falling into the template that we all developed together for the group, or does that require changes? Are you able to use that as a way? Is that prism working, I guess?
And I think rather than me answering that question, I'd like to actually put it back to Carlton, Drew, and Fabro, who have actually been presenting today and have had the firsthand issue. And then David also has. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped you. Yes, yes. And David, too. Did I skip you?
Twice.
Well, you know, if anything's worth doing, David, it's worth doing twice.
I'd just like to say we're also going to ask you to do a full demonstration of what you made us all do if you carry on like this.
I thought that was going to be our secret.
So just to refine the question, as you were doing reports on the reading list, do you feel that it was unduly limiting, like thinking you were having to leave things out that you would rather have included because of the template, or was it a good kind of guiding way to present the information? That's really the question.
This is Drew for the record. I think it was a good way to weed out issues that weren't relevant to the new GTLD program.
but were interesting, because I think without the template, we would have gotten a bit more lost in the weeds. So I think it was good, especially to emphasize the fact that we needed to come up with, or we needed to see what research questions existed in the readings, and then perhaps, you know, formulate our own at the end and see where that led us. So I think that was probably helpful for, I don't want to speak on behalf of everyone, but it, as a spectator, even for other people's presentations, it sounded like it was helpful.
Yeah, I think it helped. Not all of them will fit neatly into the framework. This FAC one, for example, won't fit neatly into the framework, but it helps. I tell you why, because if you focus on the topics, the questions that we want answered, it helps a lot to bring focus to it. Not everyone will fit, but enough of them fit to make it worthwhile, as far as I'm concerned.
And David, who absolutely presented today and cogently too, please share your views on this with us.
David, for the record, yeah. Thank you very much for that. That's getting better.
Yeah.
And that's why Laureen is Laureen and Jonathan is Jonathan. Well, I can only reiterate now, I think, yes, it certainly helped focus, having that in mind as you're going through. I find it a little bit difficult to make the things fit in where you wanted to, the research. I think, hey, what research do we need to do to get to this point? I don't know. So I left it blank. But, I mean, I think we can discuss that and we'll refine it. So the focus is there and definitely useful.
I mean, again, check this logic. The thing you were reporting on was the research for that particular row. That was the idea, is that that whatever that document, that study was, et cetera, was the research, and then was it helpful, and what kind of conclusions were you able to draw from it? It was the idea, anyway. Okay, Jordan.
All right, so we spent almost all of our time on working on defining projects that we attempted to map to the six big questions that our group is trying to answer. Stan had done some admirable work in advance of seeding our list of projects, and we went through that list and then spent some time talking about data availability and general principles of using data, and then spent a little bit of brainstorming time and discussion talking about individual projects that we might do to help address the big questions that we're trying to answer. So examples of those ranged from relatively simple analysis of existing data. So, for example, Stan had suggested that in addition to the market share data, the analysis group is already calculating for the new TLDs, that we also calculate some market concentration statistics like the four-firm and eight-firm concentration statistics and the HHIs. That's just, I think, taking numbers that analysis group already has and running them through an equation. So that's relatively straightforward. At the other end of the spectrum, I think we identified a desire to see, for example, what effect the new GTLD program has had on resale prices or listed prices in the secondary market of, for example, .com domains. And for that, we would have to get price data from an aftermarket player like Cedo and actually look and see what the price changes have been like. So some of the projects are quite simple, and some of them we know what we want to do. We just need to actually see whether we have the data availability or not. The good news is I think we started the day without projects identified for, I think, four of the six big questions that we wanted to answer, and now we have at least one project identified for all six of them. So I think that gives us a rough outline of where we're looking for data analysis to occur in order to attempt to answer each of those six big questions. And I think in general we feel like, I would say for probably 80% of those projects, we have reasonable either ideas of where the data is or reasonable access to the data already. And for the other 20%, it's a little bit more speculative as to whether we could get it or not. We rejected a couple of projects that were proposed because they seemed too cumbersome to perform, and there's one or two others where we've asked the staff to come back to us and let us know what they think is feasible. I also note there's a couple of the projects that actually interrelate. I think the safeguards and trust team may already be doing essentially the same work, and we would happily delegate our projects to you if that's the case. So, for example, one of the questions came up is like, is the and actually some of this may be happening as a result of the TMCH review as well, but for example, is the TMCH, has the TMCH reduced costs for trademark holders in terms of UDRP or URS disputes? So I don't know if you guys are looking at that or not, but if so, that would be great. If not, we'll either do it ourselves or look to the TMCH review to do it. And there was one other topic too, but we'll, pardon? That's too vague to...
Wait a minute, we had a long
Megan's time. Telling me that safeguards is the other thing, but obviously there's a large, that's a large surface area. So maybe tomorrow, I think tomorrow we have a session where we're doing a more formal information exchange, so we'll make sure we're prepared with our topics by then for further discussion. And then we spent the last little bit of our time talking about market definitions. One of the things that when we're taking a look at the issue, the topic of competition, the question is competition in what market? And although I think we don't believe we're necessarily going to become able to come up with a canonical definition of what the market looks like, what we're attempting to do is come up with several sort of hypotheses for what markets look like and say, if this was the market definition, how is competition working within that market? We have three subgroups working to come up with high market segmentation definitions. One's based on topic area, one's based on geography, and one's based on language. The topic area group is doing quite well. They've come up with a little bit of a head start because an analysis group had already done some segmentation based on topic area in their phase one report and presumably again in the phase two report. And so this would be grouping TLDs by like photos, photography, pics. Those would all sort of be a topically related market. The second and third groups are doing a little less well. We're going to spend some time tomorrow in person trying to come up with lists of TLDs that group together during our breakout. And we had a good discussion at the end about sort of agreeing that we were defining these groupings based on whether or not that we thought that the TLDs within the group would serve as substitutes for each other, because that's really what's going to form the market. That's, I think, a rough summary of our activities today.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks, Loreen. And thanks, everyone, for your hard work this afternoon. As you know, tomorrow morning we're going to have a breakout session that includes all of us, and be talking about the application evaluation process and going through a similar exercise to what you just went through of developing what the questions are in the, as we've come to put it on the composition, the competition and choice subteam, the projects, which at the very simplest level are like calculations we might perform, right, to look at how to answer some of the questions that we've identified that weren't in overlap with the PDP. So that's something to look forward to in the morning, so get your head there. Go back to the project implementation report as something to for some late night reading after dinner and to get in that headspace for the morning. As you've all probably have noticed, Dr. Crocker has joined us because he happened to be downtown already and heard that we were in town and as it turns out now can't join us for dinner, and so. I thought I would give the floor to you for a few minutes to share your thoughts on the review, its role in the universe, and competition in the DNS.
Right. I don't have anything really substantive to say. I'm delighted this is going on. This is the fourth of the AOC reviews, and it's been long awaited, and now it's happening. So we have no track record on how this goes, and from what I can tell from my brief experience here today and watching the run-up to it, you guys are very well organized, committed. It's really a pleasure to see. But I will as a sort of way to close the afternoon, share a small anecdote which you may appreciate. I took a formal course, paid a lot of money devoted to how to chair a board. They actually have courses in this. at INSEAD. It was a high-class course, three intensive days. It's a whole series of different issues, but one of the things was the shape of the table, basically, and where people are seated. And one of the problems that I had wrestled with over a long period of time was we have a board that's sort of about the size of this, and it's hard to see all the way and so forth. And one of the problems that I had, this is a very, very small, what my son would say, a humble problem, is one of the board members was continually annoyed that I wasn't calling on. And I can tell you that in the internal social structure that one keeps in one's mind, this is not a board member that I would ordinarily overlook. So I got the, all of a sudden I had a flash of insight that if I rearranged the shape of the table so instead of a U like this, it was a closed circle and we could bring people closer together, that it would work. So I did that. And we now have put a lot of energy into that and made sure that we did that. So then we have the next meeting and same thing happened. I had to diagnose what the problem was. This particular board member leaned back and the sight line was just wrong. And so the next time we convened after a break, I had a name for that person and put that, you know, right next to me. And they picked up the name and moved it to somewhere else. But anyway, so I was thinking of you, you know, David, you wouldn't be a guy that would ordinarily be overlooked. And it just brought it all back into...
It worked.
You might be doing some other things that are important, but that's what I got out of this meeting.
What are the lessons that you learned in the board chairmanship class? What are the takeaways that interview is tough?
Well, the mixture of things. We had 22 people. We had the same number of people in the class as we typically have on our board, and the boards that they were all from are typically four or five people. And so when we go around the table, I say, well, this is the size of our board. There'd be this gasp. Like, how can you possibly manage anything like that? There were issues of making sure that if you have cliques that you break them up, and then there were issues of how to keep people motivated in the face of big adversity and a whole series of other things. Happy to share the syllabus with you if you want.
Well, I'm sorry, Jonathan. One question that comes to mind is that I know that one of the things you do with your board is divide them up into sub-teams as well to discuss particular topics or something and then come back and present findings to the broader board to some extent. Is that...
I wouldn't have gravitated toward that description. We have committees, which are standing committees that have territory. I mean, you know, topic, subject matter. So we have a finance committee, an audit committee, a risk committee, a organizational effectiveness committee. I'm missing one or two. I'm sorry? A board governance committee, of course, yes. I think that's the bulk of them. And each of them have an ongoing agenda and some things that they have to do. And then they report up to the board. So we structure those each year, assign people to them, and so forth. And then we have, in addition to that, sometimes working groups that are less formal, and we put them together if there's something. We don't typically get together in workshop format like this. We have occasionally and then sent people off to do things, had some exercises, mixed feelings about those depending upon what the time, what it is, like that. I know there's a lot of mystery about what the board does, and it's finally penetrated into my mind that we should do something about that. I've really spent most of my energy trying to get the board to operate efficiently so that we're not in the way. We, prior to my being chair, my prior two chairs had enormous physical stamina, and we had sessions going on to 3 a.m. where they were personally rewriting and drafting resolutions, and it was physically painful. It's also very bad craftsmanship. I mean, it's just bad to do that. So the reason why the public board meetings that we have are so boring is because we get the work done ahead of time and then it is pro forma. And I viewed that as a feature, but I have now understood with all of the discussion that that isn't, because that isn't where the real work goes on, nobody has any idea what we really do. And so we're working on how to move, you know, greater transparency and all of that. That's way off topic from what you guys are doing here. You're operating at a very interesting moment in time where the affirmation of commitment reviews are being brought into the bylaws. I'm not sure this particular review, I haven't paid any attention to it, but I don't know what its future will be. I don't know how that plays out. I mean, it's one thing to do a review of security, stability, and accountability and transparency are going to be perennial. This one is tied to the pace of the GTLD program. And, you know, I'm just anticipating an issue of 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the pike as to what the next one will look like. But fortunately, it won't be my problem.
Okay, does anybody else have any other, thank you. Does anybody else have any other business or questions for Dr. Cocker? Anything else you want to bring up before we give you a little break before dinner? Anyone else?
I can't see you, David.
No, I do. Thanks, Steve. I do have a quick question for Steve, which is just on this. If there's one thing you'd like to see coming out of this team, what would it be? Apart from a report.
Well, look, the common sense of it is this. A huge amount of work went into the applicant guidebook. Opened the window. Lots of applications came in. A lot of issues were associated with those that then had to be sorted out that were not 100% pre-cooked. And so now we're at the point of having to look back and say what issues came out of that we should know about. And all of this is the pressure is to open the window again and either on an episodic basis or on a continuing basis and go back into business, as it were. That's where a lot of the pressure is. Identify, so the answer to your question is it would be great to have crisp, significant issues identified. So I'm sure there's a lot of little issues and so forth, but ones that are easy to understand what the issue is, and then however complicated the answer has to be, that's fine. And then we're all in a position where we can explain it to everybody and at the same time not trivialize things. And it won't surprise me if there aren't answers to certain kinds of questions. But that would be, you guys will know better what issues there are to come out of. I wish I could be more cogent, but I'm really in listening mode, and I will continue to pay attention as this comes along. I understand that the target is end of the year for a draft, and so that means probably Hyderabad. There'll be something substantive to chew on, or listen to, or pre-drafts, or whatever. And Hyderabad is a longer meeting, and so I'm sure that we'll find some time to interact and chat. And feel free to queue to send alerts in. The board will be obviously in Hyderabad. The board will also have its own retreat mid-September. And if there are topics that we want to put on the agenda so that we can educate the board or give them alert or get them up to speed on something, I'd be delighted to do that.
That's interesting. We should probably consider that.
You shouldn't take that as pressure. I mean,
no,
just,
sure.
It's just, I'm just laying out.
Opportunity.
Yeah, it's opportunity.
See this opportunity.
We've been in a very, very high-pressure situation where trust is always at issue, and I'm conscious that words that I've just spoken will be say, Crocker said you have to be done by so-and-so. That's not the case.
We would never do that.
Right.
So the I'll come to you shortly. I have a feeling we're addressing some of those things. One is ways to times
along the way that we might interact with the public as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think thinking of the board as a separate part of the public is worthwhile as well. But what I think was cogent, actually, was this notion of focusing on significant questions. And there was a lot of consternation about the fact that the PDP for subsequent procedures was essentially launched at the same time as the review. And at some logic level, it would make sense that that would follow the review, right, because it would use the review as input. But when we came down to brass tacks and really went at it with them in an interactive way about where we wanted to focus our attention, what we, I think, discovered is that they were going to work on a lot of detail-oriented fixes to the application guidebook, for example, and specific implementation issues, whereas under our application and evaluation review, the portion of our review focus on that, we're going to work on maybe why there weren't enough applicants from the developing world, right? And so I see that as sort of fitting with your notion of asking a big question and letting the PDP in some ways focus on really shoring up a lot of the deficiencies that came up along the way in the program, and that we're not getting to that level of granularity.
Yeah, so you just touched on an interesting topic, and let me be very candid about that. The idea that the observation that we didn't have very many applications from the developing world is conflated in my mind with the idea that we should have had many from the, and if you step back, I think it's important to ask the question why. What, now there may be an answer to that, but in my mind it is not those two ideas are not exactly the same. And I'm not an expert in the developing world. We've got all kinds of people here who are, but I think it's, if you go into different portions of the world and say, what do you need most in terms of the internet, I have a suspicion that new TLDs doesn't come up at the top of the list. We've had a little bit of that kind of interaction on the board. We had a meeting in Senegal several years ago, and we had a couple of prominent people from the continent come and talk to us. And one of the main takeaways was, we don't need money, we need expertise. We can find the money to do things, but their problems were bandwidth partly, but also how to build stronger CCTLD operations and a variety of other things. Except for IDNs, which have a big positive impact, it wasn't evident that simply putting in more TLDs into a region made a significant difference. The other thing we took some half measures, as you know, in the last round, and we allocated a couple $1 million to subsidize some applications. And I really thought that was too little of the wrong thing. The $185,000 fee is the smallest portion of what it really takes to run a TLD. A million or $2 million if you're going to get going, in which case you're talking about a business, and you better have a business plan, you better know what you're doing there. And and I think, you know, even broadly, never mind the developing world, we don't know how many of the TLDs that have been applied for are going to survive and what their impact is going to be. I think we've got a lot of sorting out to do in the market. And if the question is asked, well, if you didn't know all that, why did you let the program go? And the answer was, well, that's exactly why we let the program go, is because we didn't know the answers. We didn't know enough to say no, and the default has to be let innovation and let experimentation happen.
Thanks, Steve. I think we're sort of on the same page. Right now it's just an observation about the developing world and trying to form different hypotheses, and one of them is, in fact, that it wasn't a priority, right? So it may come down to cost, but it may also come down to the fact that it wasn't a priority for businesses or potential applicants in the third world to make those to new gene TLDs. So we're trying very hard not to be normative on the face, unless the answer comes back, but for more access to resources or something, we would have done it, right? Then it feels like there might have been a flaw in the program. If it's we don't think that that's what the market is here,
right,
and that's why we didn't, then we just walk away from it.
And one of the things to be careful in terms of trying to facilitate or incentivize programs in less well-endowed areas is that they can easily be taken over by external actors who then take advantage of the fact that there's an incentive in an area, and they'll get somebody as a figurehead, and then but it's really run from the outside. You have that in the U.S. You have government programs. You have 8A funding, for example, for minority and women, and so you find a whole lot of jockeying around just to get that kind of money, but it doesn't necessarily empower the people that it's supposed to empower. So it's a tricky business.
Definitely. Carlos?
Thank you, Jonathan. Actually, I was going to ask the same question Jonathan put on the table, the relationship between this cycle of reviews that we are planning now that they are in the bylaws and all these parallel PDPs. I mean, we have it in the case of the right protection mechanism, who is new subsequent rounds, and we're planning already to start the next who is and so on once the bylaws are there. I mean, what would be your view, because I cannot ask officially about the board, how to organize or coordinate this other than delaying the cycles, how to coordinate between reviews and policy work?
So this is just me, not speaking for the board, not having had a conversation like this with the board, but I understand.
Please,
the question.
Yes.
Everybody's aware of the fact that we're reviewed to death. We've got multiple streams of reviews. My view of this is that this has to be rationalized over time, and that we're so caught up with the frenetic effort to get the transition forward, we're going to be left with a somewhat unwieldy and not fully integrated set of things. And so there's a workload over the next few years to sort this out. Not a happy answer, but I think that's the nature of the exercise that the whole community has taken on. And if we just did something simple, like say, well, let's just defer a bunch of reviews, then some other set of people will say, oh, you're just trying to get out of that. And so I think I see staff members around here who actually have to do the work. What's your view?
I have the same worry you have.
Yeah.
And I shared some of my concerns this morning with Larry Strickland when he was talking about the same sort of thing, about getting the community engaged and making sure that there's enough attention paid to these issues.
Yeah.
So let me tell you a difference between the beginning of this review and the other one. It was very impressive to get here and know that staff had already begin to report on the new GTLDs, as the GDD had already started the work. The community had prepared the indices, and the corporation had already hired Nielsen and analysis to prepare the stuff. They weren't ready, let's say, but it was impressive the amount of work that was already ongoing when we started. If I compare it with ATRT 2, that we have to start looking what happened with ATRT 1. So it was a very good start this time.
I really didn't mean to take up this much airtime. I was just dropping by.
Anything else? I would give you guys a breather, and we meet at 7:30. What is the equivalent of two blocks from here, really?
It's a short walk.
And we'll see you all there at 7:30. Oh, I don't actually know.
Yeah.
I think meeting there. That's why you got a map and everything.
Did we get a map?
You did get a map. If you would like, I'd be happy to meet you at 7:30 in the lobby and walk with you. That would be helpful.
With you,
it's in me.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay.